All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fuckadelics? What's happening? It's Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. How are you? Today on the show is the amazing Matt Sweeney. Don't know who Matt Sweeney is? You should. I'll explain it to you later. All right? Okay, but let's do this now. Couple things. Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, October 16th and around there. Go to WTFpod.com, go to my calendar, and you can get informed on when I'm going to be there. Things are looking up. Everything's okay. I'm looking forward to come to Australia. I think I'll be worth it. I'm going to put on a good show. I'll give you the extra added, and I'll hang out and press the flesh and take some pictures and hold some babies if you'd like. I'm not encouraging anyone to bring babies to the show. All right, that was troublesome. September 19th, I'll be at PodFest, and my guests on the live podcast will be Los Angeles radio legend Jim Ladd and Los Angeles other radio legend Fraser Smith. We're going to talk about the old days, back when podcasting was some sort of weird futuristic idea that no one even came up with. What? Doing a pre-recorded radio show in your house? Come on! That's crazy talk! What? The President of the United States is going to come to your house? No way! You're out of your fucking mind, man! You should be on medicine! What else? Oh yeah, John Hodgman was supposed to come on. We were going to hang out and do something because he's got a thing going on, and I like to help my pals. I like Mr. Hodgman. Hodgman and I have been through some shit. I lost two of his fucking episodes before we finally nailed one. I didn't lose one. I lost one. The other one stunk, not because of him, because of the situation. It was a live situation. But then we got a good one. But he's out and about. He's out on the road. He's on tour with his new show, Vacation Land. Over the weekend, it kicked off. But you can see him all over the country for the next few weeks. Go to johnhodgman.com/tour to see the Hodge Man. So, Matt Sweeney. All right, here's the deal with Matt Sweeney. Blake Mills. Matt Sweeney's a guitar player, but he's also a guy that I think he's a guy that people like to have around. And that's not a bad quality. Blake Mills said, you and Matt Sweeney got to hang out. And I'm like, who's Matt Sweeney? So then I start looking into Matt Sweeney. He does this thing for on YouTube for Vice, I believe, called Guitar Moves. And it's just him sitting with a guitar player, him trying to learn shit from the guitar player. I can appreciate that. Matt seems like a pretty good guitar player, but I still don't know who he is. Then I find out Matt's in this band called Chavez. I don't fucking know anything about Chavez because I'm not late to the party. I just missed the fucking party completely. But fortunately now, the party's ongoing. There's no more missing the party. So I get Chavez's Greatest Hits, which is a, you know, like a double CD. I listen to that sort of over and over again in Florida. It's kind of punk rock, kind of art rock, kind of math rock, whatever you want to call it. It's a thing. So then I'm like, so now I'm in the Matt Sweeney situation. I understand Matt Sweeney. And then I remember I got this fucking record from Drag City by Matt Sweeney and Bonnie Prince Billy, Will Oldham. I got a lot of Will Oldham records. I can only take so many at a time. I listen to them slowly. But the Matt Sweeney Will Oldham record, Super Wolf, is a fucking great record. It's one of those records, I didn't really know who Matt Sweeney was. I knew a little bit about Will Oldham and Bonnie Prince Billy. But Super Wolf, I put it on without knowing anything. And I'm like, what is this magical piece of fucking wax? God damn it. What is this? The Super Wolf album is fucking monumental. It's one of the best records I fucking have. I love that goddamn record. And that's a Matt Sweeney, Will Oldham joint, that thing. So now I'm a little more hip to Matt Sweeney. And then I finally meet him. And man, like, we hung out in New York. He went with me. We went to an amp shop. We played some guitar. He showed me some Burnside licks. And then we hung out. He's part owner of a fucking veggie burger down there in the East Village called Superiority Burger. But he's one of those dudes, you know those dudes you meet in your life where you're like, that, I wonder what that dude's up to. Let's call him up and see what's going on with him. He's that guy. I've never been that guy. No one has ever said, man, maybe we should call Maron and have him come. That's never happened unless it was out of sympathy. But Sweeney seems like one of those cats where it's sort of like, yeah, I kind of want to hang around with that guy. He seems cool. He may not cop to that, but I think that's sort of who he is. But he's got some fucking stories, man, because he was sort of around it. He's kind of like, I don't know how you describe it, but shit just happens to him and they're pretty important somehow. And he makes great music. And then I find out from him that, you know, he's involved with the Endless Boogie record, that he's involved with like, you know, him and Blake are buddies. It's crazy. You just have to listen to it. And then he just told me that he's part of this other thing that, of course, maybe you Pitchfork readers know about this shit, but I don't fucking know about shit. I don't know about anything. But this Soldiers of Fortune record, which is like some super group of alt people, Kid Millions, Barry London, Jesper Eklow, Brad Trow, Mike Bones. I didn't know any of those people till this morning. But anyways, I'm happy Matt and I are friends. He sends me music to listen to, and we chit chat about shit, about guitars and things. He's a good cat, and this was a fun talk. Before I bring you Matt Sweeney, the music on today's show is some of my guitar noodling that's been mixed with full instrumentation by this dude, DJ Copley. He's on Twitter as WebPuppy45 if you want to check out his stuff. Matt Sweeney, now. I've had this. This is like the $90 chocolate?
Yes.
Where the fuck do they make this?
They make it in Brooklyn.
Right.
And I'm friends with the guys, and I asked them, because they give this shit to me for free, and I got addicted to it. So I was eating like two a day. I was like working on a record. So I was hooked.
That's how they get you.
Yeah,
you're exactly. Friends.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about you, Matt Sweeney.
Yes.
Hi. Who the fuck aren't you friends with?
Huh?
I mean, I like you. You got a chocolate connection. You know Johnny Cash.
I'm old.
Sam Dillon taught you how to play guitar. Not even a Dillon that plays guitar.
He's the best guitar player, Dillon. Sam Dillon. He's incredible.
How'd you know that guy?
He went to Hampshire College.
Went to Hampshire?
No, I went to Northwestern, but my three best friends from New Jersey all went to Hampshire College, all kind of separately.
You grew up in New Jersey?
Uh-huh, in Maplewood and South Orange. My dad taught at Seton Hall University.
What did he teach?
He was Chaucer.
He's all Chaucer? Canterbury Tales all day
long?
I mean,
that and classics. Medieval English was his specialty. And he taught there for 50 years. And by the end, he just got to do an honors class where he would take him around the world. Yeah. And he would have like a month-long trip that he would take a class to and stuff.
So he grew up in academia?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And your mom, was she a teacher?
My mom met my dad when she was teaching at Seton Hall, but then she became a lawyer and then became a judge.
Your mom's a judge?
Federal judge.
To this day. And your dad's an academic.
He's a scholar. He's no longer with us, but he was an academic, but he never published. He was a Jesuit, right?
Yeah.
And in 1957, he left, which was Vatican II. Does anybody know about Vatican II?
Sure. I'll pretend like I do. Okay. I remember it being something.
The Catholic Church changed all the rules, right. And they kind of got lax, and they got rid of the Latin Mass, and they got rid of everything that my dad was interested in, like all the kind of incense and
all the witchcraft.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, because the Jesuits are into the what's the word? You know. Not magic with a K, but spiritual
the swinging arcane. Orbs, orbs.
So he bails, and he's 27, and he moves to Bleecker and McDougal in 1957.
Oh, gets his mind blown.
A virgin.
A virgin Jesuit moves to that place, to Jazzland.
Yeah, yeah. And he got a tenured position at Seton Hall at a really young age, and so he never cared about publishing. He just wrote it out. But he was a bagpiper. He was really into music, and he played in like 10 different bands.
Bagpipes?
Yes.
Did he play on AC/DC's first album?
No, because I don't really think those are bagpipes.
Have you studied it?
There's the way that it starts in that song. It sounds like a. It sounds like a synthesizer to me.
Long Way to the Top if you want to rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Matt Sweeney here on this show has said that it's a synthesizer.
I think. I mean, but
it's
I know
okay.
That,
I just want you to come down one side or the other. Bagpipe or synthesizer?
I think that on the record is a synthesizer, but I know that Bon Scott used to play the bagpipe live, and apparently it was really difficult, and it was a huge chore for him, and it was like a prop that he
really
made.
A huge chore for a dwarf alcoholic to play the bagpipes?
Yeah. It was a little rough.
It winded the little man.
I grew up around music and stuff,
but that's very sophisticated highbrow upbringing.
It was cool. They weren't into rock and roll, which was really nice.
What was your first instrument? Did you learn to play clarinet? Really?
Yeah,
clarinet player.
Well, because back when you had to play an instrument in schools,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
I think my dad kind of chose it for me.
Yeah, I think my brother played clarinet briefly. You got to wet your reed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then blow a few tunes out. Did you have any a proclivity to it? Or
I couldn't read music well, but I could memorize anything. So I kind of got far just bullshitting, you know, like I sat, you know, like in first chair, whatever that means. And
sure.
I could play, but I really didn't know what I was reading. I would just like hear it once and then just kind of figure it out.
Really? So you had that and you could play the clarinet?
Yeah, yeah.
You got brothers and sisters?
I got an older brother who lives in L.A. who makes, he plays music as well. He does music for Kitchen Nightmares.
Yeah? Well, I don't know them.
You know Kitchen? No,
I don't.
The TV show, dude.
Oh, really?
The Gordon Ramsay show.
Gordon Ramsay show? Yeah. He's the guy going
like boom.
Yeah. When Gordon Ramsay loses his shit and yells at people to get it together and storms out into the street, your brother's music comes in. You can watch that and go, that's my bro.
Yes. He does all those cues and all that stuff.
God bless him for helping out. So, all right. So you're in New Jersey. So that means you're close to Hoboken. You're close to New York.
That's correct.
You have access. How old are you?
Now I'm 45.
All right. So you're a little younger than me, but we're old guys, kind of.
Yeah.
But you were old, you know, you're old enough to have been young enough to sort of get into the end of the punk rock shit here.
Absolutely. I was really lucky because, so, you know, I was in high school from like 80, you know, in the mid 80s when everything sucked. Everything I thought was terrible, but there's really healthy.
Hey, I was there in the late 70s.
That was better a little bit, but it was kind of shitty too. But what I mean by that is that there's an underground, like there is such a need, like what was mainstream was so terrible that there's this need for an underground, and there was tons of great music. So like I got into hardcore music kind of via skateboarding, and then
when that happened, because I remember when I was in high school from like 77 to 81, like disco, we saw it die, but punk didn't integrate until later. So we got new wave,
right?
Was what the mainstream music became, and then mainstream rock was like I was in high school when the first Van Halen album came out, and the first Dire Straits album came out, and Foreigner was around. There was a lot of Hot Blooded. Yeah. I think that was early on.
I love that shit. Actually, I really love Foreigner. I think it's music I liked when I was like a little kid. I heard it at the amusement park, and I remember.
Sure, man.
But
feels like the first time.
Oh yeah.
So you're in high school and processing the skate shit.
Yeah. And I see a picture of his band. It's a bunch of guys, and it says the Sun City Girls, and it just kind of. And I think I saw a picture of the Butthole Surfers, and that was it. I was like, I have to know what this stuff is. And then
Butthole Surfer does require that of you. It's like, what is that?
Yeah, and you know, this is like 83 or 84, and you're like,
how old are you?
At that point, I'm 13. You know,
oh my god.
Yeah, you know, it was.
You're
it was
enchanted
completely, and I'd already gotten into music, and I really loved like Rush and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that, and I was already playing music, but when I heard that stuff it just blew my mind, and I really got into that stuff. So then by the end of high school I had a band, and we got to open up for Sonic Youth, you know, when I was
which
like,
band was that?
We were called Skunk.
That was like famous though, like aren't you, isn't that relatively well known?
We're goofy. I cringe when I hear it, although the guitar stuff is really cool, but we didn't know what we were doing. We were really, really young,
right?
And it was kind of very Minneapolis sounding, very like
Husker Du,
that Replacements and Soul Asylum, who were actually they were so well. That sounds lame, actually.
What?
But I don't want to say they were actually great, but in the 80s they were so incredible. That band in particular, I remember because I grew up in this arena rock, got into punk rock, and then saw Soul Asylum open up for Husker Du, and they kind of sounded like Aerosmith or something like that. But they were so like
tight
and violent,
little neutered, really just violent.
No, they were bad ass.
Really?
They were so good. And ask anybody who was there, they will swear that Soul Asylum in 1986 was the best like kind of post-punk band going.
No, I know that, but then there's the whole sort of like, well, what the fuck happened?
I don't know.
It seemed like a cultural turn more than a turn of them as a band.
Yeah, I mean, it was weird. But actually, also when you're in high school, you love a band and then you don't like a band anymore.
Yeah.
Like they make one lame movie. You're like, oh my God, fuck them. You know?
But like, how much older is your brother?
My brother's 2 years older. He was like more straight, kind of like he had Jersey Shore type buddies and stuff like that. So he was playing...
Springsteen?
That kind of stuff, and his band was like, yeah, they were like, they would play high school dances.
Oh, he had a band.
Yeah, he's an incredible drummer. He was like the Rush guy. He like worked a couple of summers, got the giant Neil Peart Rush set.
Did he get a gong?
Yeah, we had
a gong.
He had the whole fucking thing. Yeah. he smoked. He was like the most. He was like the drummer in town. So then,
did he play alone at home with earphones on?
A little bit. But he always had kids to play with him. Yeah. We had like the rock house. You know, right. Like we had the house that my dad was like. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, but he was like, if you want to play sports or do music, I'll foot the bill.
Right.
You know, like so. And then, my parents divorced in high school, and my dad kind of was sort of depressed, and the house, I was just completely unsupervised and completely. And it's amazing. And luckily I wasn't into drugs or anything like that. I was just into music. And so my house was this
what, your
free
dad was
zone.
Just what, in the room?
He was kind of like, he was puttering in the basement and, you know, hanging out with his bagpiper buddies. And he was kind of like,
so your dad was sad.
He was sad.
Wandering about and occasionally would play bagpipes with some other men.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But it was a really great scene. So we got to, you know, I got to play tons and tons and tons of music and kind of figure stuff out. And I got to like hate on my brother's friends who were like kind of technical kind of rock jocks.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, because I was kind of good at memorizing stuff, I would like act like I hated them and watch them play and then like figure out a Metallica.
You still do that. You make short pieces where you do that.
Guitar
moves, right?
Yeah.
It's you going like, oh, fuck, I'm playing with this guy.
That's some of those, like the Gibbons one was insane.
Well, it was kind of weird and sad to see Billy get sort of loopy. Like he got his face all red from the wine.
It's this one moment, he turns, you see him, he goes, done deal. But he's incredible. I mean, that was, well, you were asking how I know a lot of people. And other than the fact that I started young playing in bands, you know, and making records at a pretty young age. So I got to meet a lot of people that way.
Let's talk about Skunk though, because
Skunk is amazing. Oh my God.
But like you were, what, 14, 15?
When I started playing with those dudes,
What guitar are you playing?
I had like a Yamaha guitar, and then I got a Les Paul my freshman year in college.
Black one?
I got a black one. Yeah. I got what are they called? Black Beauties. Yeah.
Two gold humbuckers.
Yep.
That was your good. That's not a punk rock guitar.
No, but the thing is, by the time that we started doing a band, we'd already kind of been punk hardcore as we knew it. Had kind of the first wave had run their course, meaning Black Flag had broken up. That's one way of putting it. You know what I mean? And like, I think you talked with Kirk from the Meat Puppets about this, just like this, things had moved on. So by the time that I was playing a band, we were kind of post-punk and into like arena rock and into like guitar solos and stuff like that.
Really?
Like, yeah. And like, it was really goofy.
Which guys?
Iron Maiden, knowing that it was not cool to cover Iron Maiden.
So there is ironic.
It was, but we loved it. You know what I mean?
So it
was.
But for the audience, you knew that it was read ironically.
Yeah, like we were kind of pushing it. A band like Red Cross at the time was like our favorite. Was one of our favorite bands.
Right.
And again, they were really retro, and they would cover Kiss songs and stuff. But they were one of the first punk bands, so you know.
Right. Like, so it was cool. It was cool.
Yeah.
They can take the piss out of this by playing it perfectly.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And again, through there was a guy called Andrew Weiss who was Ween's guy. Like us and Ween both got recorded by this guy named Andrew Weiss, who
this is Skunk?
This is Skunk, yeah. I met Ween when we were in high school. Are you
they
a Ween
were in
fan?
High school? I've not entered the world completely.
Oh my God.
But
watch the guitar moves I did.
I watched it.
Did you watch the one with Mickey from Ween?
He's great.
Yeah, he's like,
wizard.
Yeah, I mean, and they were like our favorite band, and we kind of came up with them, you know. And
They were kids too.
They were like a year younger. Yeah, and they started when they were like 13 or something like that. I met them when they were like 15 or 16, all through this guy Andrew in Trenton.
In Jersey,
yeah. This is all like
kind of Jersey
weird DIY stuff. You know what I mean? Kind of post-punk, kind of like City Gardens we played a lot at. Maxwell's we played a lot at.
What's the story over at Maxwell's? You were like a high school band playing at Maxwell's.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And we were such dicks. Oh, my God. We were such assholes.
You know, I played Yo Tango's Hanukkah Weeks.
Yes.
Yeah. And you got to tell me the story again about how Ira had to show you how to... What was that about?
Poor Ira had to... Okay, so Steve, the owner of Maxwell's, really liked Skunk for some reason. And he's like, you guys have to get a sound guy because we're really loud, you know? And he's like, and he knew that we were going to go on tour. And he goes, do you have a buddy who can do your sound? We were like, sure. So we got my friend Paul to come to Maxwell's. Yeah. He's like, I'll have our house sound guy teach your guy how to do sound. I'll give you guys an afternoon. Meanwhile, like... If I were Ira, I don't think that there's a note of Skunk's music that he would like. We were like kind of, I think, everything that he hated.
Right,
you know,
right.
Because we were like really obnoxious and like, again, doing Iron Maiden songs and shit like that. And like, so he has to show up and he was just like,
he was a sound guy?
Yeah. He had to show up and show our friend who didn't know anything about sound. And so we were just like, we just made noise and played like awful heavy metal for like 3 hours and knowing... We knew exactly how much he hated it.
I wonder if he remembers that. Yeah. All right, so you're doing Skunk.
Okay, so I'm doing it.
Find some success.
I mean, sort of. I mean, like, getting to open up for. I think our first real show was opening for Sonic Youth and Dinosaur. That's a pretty big show.
Where was that? In Jersey?
That was at City Gardens. And then we played with Sonic Youth at CB's. And at that time, it was really, for me, exciting because like 86, 87, all the bands that we really liked just made these really great records. Like Dinosaur made You're Living All Over Me, which is like this great record.
Yeah.
Sonic Youth made Sister. You know, like all these bands were really kind of peaking, you know. And I'm like in high school, just like all I cared about was this stuff. So I was really, really stoked.
Right.
And then the band kind of collapsed because we went to college. And everybody went to different schools. But over breaks, we kind of got a little better and we made some demos with that same guy, Andrew Weiss. And then we got signed to Twin Tone Records, which was like the Replacements label and Soul Asylum's label. And we were kind of barely a band at that point because, I mean, we were all just college kids and we didn't live together. But we kind of got it together and made a record. And we kind of started to suck then.
When he got tight, things got tight.
I mean, they kind of got tight. We were just really obnoxious and we kind of blew it. Like,
really?
Yeah, I think
so. But those were the records? Those were like while you were in college or just post-college? That's when the Skunk records came out, not when you were kids?
No, yeah. In college, like we had had, you know, we were playing in senior year of high school and doing these shows, and then we got the music together over the course of like freshman, sophomore year of college, and then I think the first Skunk record came out in 89 or something like that. And then that was a really weird time. But like, put it this way, like by the time that we broke up, I felt like some sort of grizzled veteran, you know, and I was like 21. I was like really bitter, super bitter, like it was everybody's fault.
But there's got to be people out there that are like, those Skunk records were the best.
You know, there's, you know who really likes this, and I'm fully fucking name dropping, but every time I see him, he's really sweet about it, is Jack Black really likes Skunk.
He does?
I don't, some people.
He was here the last time I was here. Yeah.
He's fucking awesome. He really likes it. So some people, we do have a couple of fans. They're cute. Like the vocals are goofy, but there's a lot of ideas going on. There's a lot to that band. But anyway, so then I quit. I dropped out of college. Skunk imploded and I just didn't know what to do with myself, and I thought that I was just done with music. I was really despondent, and then I got a job in New York working for CMJ, which is like this college music journal, you know.
That was huge. They used to put out packages for the big thing.
Yeah, which was like was basically what South by Southwest is
right
now.
Then it'd be at Brownies and the Mercury Lounge and everywhere, and I used to get those packages of CMJ collections of bands.
Exactly, like compilations.
You were a guitar player.
So
you got a gig, you got a job.
I get a job but I'm like post music. I was just like kind of embarrassed about everything about how Skunk went down. I just thought that everybody hated us and
so you were hanging up your guitar?
I totally did. It was awesome. it was like, I don't know.
You're like, fuck this?
The drama, you know, like, yeah, I was
really?
Like,
really?
Yeah. And then, but then I was kind of knocking around New York and somebody heard that I was a bass player. This guy named Dave Reed heard I was a bass player, and even though I was a guitar player, and he was like, you want to start, I'm starting this band with James Lowe from Live Skull, who's a band that I really liked.
Yeah.
And I was like, sure, yeah, I play bass. So then I came in at a, I sort of came in like, okay, I'm just gonna pretend I never played in a band. I'm gonna play in somebody else's band. It's gonna be a kind of music that-
Bass.
I'm gonna play bass in like a really noisy, kind of like, this guy played with Glenn Branca, and the band sort of sounded like Helmet, but more arty and more noisy and kind of more, kind of more interesting. I don't know. And so then I started playing music again. I met this guy, James, and around that time, I also roadied for, I was just fully humiliating myself. I think the whole thing was like, I don't play. I'll be a roadie.
Experiment in shame.
Yeah.
I'm going to beat the shit out of myself.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Not only am I going to give up on my dream, but I'm going to go support others in the most menial way possible.
Exactly. I'm going to serve the
You're like a Jesuit.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is self-punishment.
Well, so Clay Tarver, this guy who I still do a band with, at that time had a band called Bullet La Volta, and they were a band.
I remember them.
Yeah, and there's like kind of like, this is around the time that before Nirvana blew up, all these bands were getting signed, and La Volta was one of these bands that was supposed to be huge. And by the time that it was that they definitely weren't going to be huge, they had this kind of big tour, and I roadied for them, and I became friends with Clay. His band broke up, and Clay moved to New York, and we went out karaokeing, and this was when there wasn't karaoke machines, pre-karaoke machines, when there's a band, there's on 9th Street, a place called Candy B1 that had a live Japanese band that knew like 2,000 songs, and you would just get up in front of the band. That was the...
It was live karaoke.
It was live karaoke, but that's all karaoke really was live, was just like you get to be the singer.
Yeah.
You know? And so we... And I had never met the Matador guys. Clay was friends with the Matador guys, and me and Clay at this point were friends, and we were like, we would like smoke pot and talk about music and stuff like that. And also he was sort of humiliated and burnt out on playing music. And we karaoke and we did Bridge Over Troubled Water.
You too.
you and Clay. And then Clay was like, we should do a band. I think we should do a band.
Really? That was it?
And
that
the other guy who was there was Chris from Matador. That was the other dude that we were partying with like that night. And that was how this band Chavez.
That was started. The birth of Chavez?
Straight up, yeah.
Chavez is one of these bands where like I was like way late.
Right.
Somebody told me about him.
Yeah.
And then I started seeing you on Twitter, and then I started seeing you on records, and I didn't know who the fuck you were.
Yeah.
And then everyone's like, well, he was, you know, Chavez and who everyone is. I don't know who everyone is. Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, oh, and then we start like talking to each other on Twitter, and you know Blake Mills, so now I got to get the Chavez records.
Yeah.
So I go down to Florida to visit my mother with the double album with all the Chavez stuff, and I'm just running, I'm jogging, I'm listening to that shit.
Oh, cool.
And I plowed into my brain. I'm like, I got to get a handle on this guy.
Yeah.
But then that guy doesn't match up with the dude who's playing with Billy and Blake on Oh Well,
right,
or doesn't match up with the Bonnie Prince Billy that I listened to Superwolf last night.
Oh, cool.
And that like, and then like, then Endless Boogie, and then like, and then I start looking up your shit, and I'm like, who the fuck doesn't this guy play with?
Well, so it kind of went like this. So with Chavez, so we started the band, and I got a day job working for a PR company that a guy called Steve Martin.
I know, I work with them.
Yeah. Steve Martin, the asshole, not the jerk, as they say.
That's right.
Yeah. He had this idea. He was in Agnostic Front, and he was in some other cool bands. And this is when all of our friends' bands were getting signed to major labels. And Steve had this idea, like, let's start a PR company so we could represent our friends.
You were there at the beginning of Nasty Little Man?
Yeah, yeah.
So you were there, you were kind of partnering with, this is like you not committing to music still.
Yes, yeah, totally. It was, you're like, again, serving. And part of the game was like not telling anybody that I was in a band because I was, you know, I wanted to be professional.
So you're secretly doing Chavez.
Pretty much, yeah.
And doing PR for who?
We did like the Beastie Boys. We did Dinosaur Jr. We did, this is like early on.
So all of them knew you as the guy at the office?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I've like Josh from Queens, like didn't know that I played guitar for years, and a lot of
Josh Homme.
Yeah, a lot of people that I was like friends with, I just wouldn't tell them that I, you know, that I played because I thought it'd be kind of.
But you were secretly jamming.
Yeah, and us and Chavez did well, so we ended up doing pretty good. But we had this whole thing. That band was like, we had decided that we wouldn't do anything that we did not want to do, meaning that we wouldn't play with a band that we didn't like, that we wouldn't go on tour forever if there wasn't a demand for it, that we wouldn't stay on some junkie's floor, you know what I mean?
Well, tell me about the drummer. James.
Yeah. He's the best.
Because like somebody called it math rock. And
yeah.
I think it doesn't fit.
That's just racist because James is Chinese. I think that's why they...
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
I just like, I don't
it's
even know what
racist.
It is. But when I think of math rock, I think of King Crimson. So
yeah.
I was trying to place it together. I couldn't hear it.
It frustrated me at the time. Actually, you know, David Kleiler invented math rock to describe the noise band Wider that I played in, because that had a lot of weird parts. And David Kleiler, I swear to God, he called it math rock as a diss, as a joke. He would pretend to have a calculator when he was watching us. And then
with which band?
This band Wider. That was the noise band that I played in, like when I didn't know what I was doing.
That's when you do a noise band.
Yeah. They were really cool. They were really great. But they were complicated, and so this guy Dave would pretend to have a calculator at our shows, and he'd be like calculating it, and then he'd kind of like you know, give the look like yeah, you guys are
good. So he's being a dick.
He was being a dick. Yeah. And then people started straight faced, like there's a genre called math rock, you know, which was beyond me. And then Chavez started getting called that. I really do think it's because we could play. We had a Chinese drummer, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we were just trying to do, and we still are just trying to do, like, kind of like the interesting or the weird parts of Blue Oyster Cult or like Cheap Trick, you know,
right.
You know,
right,
Dream
right,
Police, yeah. the big buildup in Dream Police, you know, or like Rocks, Aerosmith, like this kind of like, we want to just kind of play evil rock, just do our
build.
Own take.
You just want the build part?
Yeah. And like, the high drama, right. But without being like, we just, that's our thing.
So you know? Chavez is doing that. And so you're doing publicity.
I'm doing publicity. I'm doing Chavez.
Where do you learn how to finger pick from Sam Dillon?
That was around that. Okay. So around that time, my friend Dan, who was one of the guys who went to Hampshire College, which is how I know Sam. Dan was
Hampshire College, fucking hippie college.
Oh man. I know. Tell me about
that's it. That's the one in Amherst, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There's Reed in Hampshire, Reed in Oregon.
Yeah, and then there's another one that closed, Antioch. That one was so hippie that they imploded themselves.
Everyone was majoring and leaving school.
No, yeah, for real. It just straight doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. I had dropped out of college, and all my friends were going to Hampshire, and they were friends with Sam Dillon, and they were the anti-hippie contingent, and they were really into like death metal and noise and Swans and all this kind of music, and Sam was like not a hippie at all.
This is Jacob's older brother.
Correct.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got to be friends, and in the quest for extreme music, somebody found a Charlie Patton record, and that
was Evil Blues.
Yeah. And there's that song. My friend Dan Margulies, who's this genius historian guy now. He got us into old time music. So he started going to these festivals, these bluegrass festivals.
Yeah, yeah.
This one in Charlotte, Michigan, which is like, we were the only young people there. And so every year we would go to this festival, and my friends started to learn how to play. And Sam just like took to finger picking. And I remember when I saw him do it, my mind was completely blown. I was like, how the fuck do you do that?
Yeah.
How do you do that? And I'd been listening to stuff, you know, I've been listening to Nick Drake, and you know, like I've been listening to finger picking stuff, like, and I love.
But he was doing like almost ragtime finger picking.
Yeah, it was just like, I mean, and like I also love Leo Kottke, like right. that 6 and 12. But I just assumed it was impossible to do.
I can't do it.
Yeah, but dude, you could totally learn.
Really?
I mean, yeah.
Is it like juggling through repetition? You get it.
Yeah, I could show you like one pattern, and that's what Sam showed me, two patterns, and everything that I do is based off of these two patterns. And it took me like a week. And I remember it's the most frustrating thing because you want to do it so bad, and it is like juggling,
right?
You know?
Eventually. You get that third ball. You get just that go really ball up.
Yeah, yeah. And dude, it opens up. Sam put it this way. Sam goes, you know why why there are old guys sitting on the porch for hours and hours drinking themselves happily to death? He's like, because they know how to do this one thing. He's like, yeah, and he's like, that's all he said. I was like, okay, you know. And
I wonder if his dad can do it.
Weirdly, he can't. He does it sparingly, but he does it on Buckets of Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Is that some
How about on? What about on Karina Karina?
Yeah, that too. Yeah,
yeah.
But he doesn't do it. He rarely does it. It's weird.
It seems like he at some point he gave up his fingers altogether.
Yeah, I mean he doesn't even play guitar anymore at all.
His hands hurt, right?
Is that the deal?
I don't know. You're his friend.
Gotta ask. So the
it's so funny to
thing,
me though. It's not the Dylan that plays.
No,
he plays, but he's not the guy who tried to be a musician.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to ask him if it's okay to talk about him because he's super private.
But doing anything other than saying you learned how to play guitar.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I do want to give him props because he's one of the best musicians that I know.
I love knowing that. I love knowing that the Dylan that doesn't even deal with music is the best musician.
You should have him on. He's a criminal defense attorney. He's a bad motherfucker. So I was doing Chavez, but then Chavez started to slow down a little bit. Just the finger picking thing was just like a separate thing. But then
you put down the pick and you only finger pick?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Really?
Because you don't really need a pick anyway. I mean, if you have to do that, you just do that. Use your nail.
Do you use your thumb?
Yeah. But the finger picking, I really got into. Then Chavez slowed down because of a bunch of different things. Like our bass player started to get too many jobs working making music videos or something like
Which
that.
One is the writer now?
Clay. Okay, so Clay Tarver.
He's a guitar player though, right?
Me and
the
Clay
other guitar
the band.
Right.
Yeah. And
Bridge Over Trouble Water.
And Clay's kind of the leader, even though like I sing and write the lyrics and stuff. Clay still is really the guy who like drives the band and stuff. And he started getting a lot of jobs, you know, writing jobs, because he worked at MTV and he was the guy who did the cab driver promos.
So there's a guitar player for Chavez. He wrote the Donal Loge promos. Just by, because he knew Donal Loge, how did he get the gig?
Yeah, they were college roommates.
So that's how that happened. He's writing for him. So then he gets wrecked. So what's his trajectory?
Clay's trajectory is he writes a script based on the cab driver, which of course never gets made, but a lot of people see. And he started getting, everybody loved that script. And so I think J.J. Abrams was the guy who started giving Clay work.
It's crazy.
It's so fucking wild. Yeah.
Then you lose your guitar player.
Oh yeah. So meanwhile, he starts doing stuff. James, our drummer, is this genius who did something with like the computer mainframe of Merrill Lynch to make the chain of command like a split second quicker.
Yeah.
You know, for money things. So there's one thing that he can do, and he helped design stents.
For hearts
or something. He
wins, your drummer.
Yes, he wins Bessie Awards for modern dance compositions. He's like so fucking advanced. So he's doing his thing. Clay's doing his thing.
And you're just a guitar
guy. Yeah, I'm this fucking idiot. You know, like, so, you know, I was like, oh, I guess I'll get good at finger picking. You know,
it sucks. It takes some time to play.
Yeah. So
are you still doing publicity?
Yeah. And it was, that job was really cool because I could kind of, you know, take on as much as I could take on and come and go. But right when Chavez was kind of done, I saw Andrew WK play.
Yeah.
And I think I had taken ecstasy for the first time. And I went up to him, and this is when Andrew's played by himself to a tape.
And, with his white pants and his white shirt.
Yeah, and he was 18, you know. And I was like, man, can I be your manager? I mean, I was
high.
I was high as shit. And he was like, okay. And in like short order, I got him like a really huge record deal. And it was the only time I ever did anything like this. And
A&R?
Yeah, and or managing, you know.
So it was his first one, the Bloody Nose one?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I made a little chunk of money because he got a record deal. And so like, then what happened? Oh yeah. And then, I ran into Billy Corgan, who was a big Skunk fan back in the day.
Really?
Yes. And, he asked me if I wanted to do a project with him. And we ended up doing that for 2 years.
What was the name of that band?
It was called The Zwan.
Right.
It was really fun. Like the first half of it was really, really fun. Like we for a year, in a year, we recorded 100 songs. We never played any, you know, we just played lots and lots of music, and it was really, really fun.
You think he's a good guitar player?
He's a great guitar player.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's incredible. But then that thing imploded because I think really he didn't really want to do what we were doing. I think it was a kind of an experiment for him.
What were you doing?
I don't really know.
Is it on record?
It's on record. I've never listened to the record, but some people like it. I remember that the record took a really long time to make. It just, I think I wasn't the guy that he hoped I was, and maybe vice versa for me and him and stuff like that. It got kind of weird. I mean, but he's a character.
Got kind of weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, but I could. There's probably enough nice things. So I did this thing for like 2 years, and then all of a sudden I'm in my early 30s and that thing's done. And all of a sudden I was like a professional musician, you know what I mean? Which I swore I'd never be.
Cause
you know?
Well, now you've managed, you've done some A&R, you've delivered.
Yeah,
then
I was like in a kind of a
right. You know how to finger pick with Sam, you were in Chavez and now you just finished with Corgan.
And then I remember I had done, and also I started playing with, you know what I did actually when Chavez slowed down, I started playing with Bonnie Prince Billy. I started playing with Will, which was a huge, huge thing. We had a mutual friend.
Who was that?
The mutual friend,
yeah.
Britt Walford, the drummer from Slint, this band that
Slint.
Who I went to college with, actually. So much college.
Well, that's, I guess, where it all starts.
Dude, most bands are like upper middle class
kids.
Who should be doctors.
Yeah.
You know?
Some of them apparently will do both, like your drummer.
He'll
a stint.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I started playing with Will. We met through Britt.
Yeah.
And then the Billy Corgan thing. All of a sudden I'm done with the Billy Corgan thing and I thought I was going to make some money.
Yeah. Doing what?
With Billy? Just from publishing stuff.
Yeah.
And like nothing. All of a sudden I did a tour with Will. I was in Tasmania at the Tasmanian Devil Park, and somehow I was again I was still pretty spacey about money and just thought things would work out, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, man.
I was like, yeah, you know, I was come in this on, band, you know, player. Like, I'm going to get some money.
Yeah.
And manager says it's going to come through, you know. So I remember going, I wanted to buy a t-shirt at the Tasmanian Devil Park, and I put in my card in the ATM, and I had like negative $25 in my bank account, and I was in fucking Tasmania. And I that was like this incredible moment.
That was the moment?
Yeah, that was the moment where I was like, whoa, I'm completely fucked, you know? And I remember not to, like, I was embarrassed. I didn't know what to do, you know? Yeah. Like, and I'm like, walk out, I'm like kind of ashen face. Will's like, are you okay? I was like, yeah, are we... Did we get in cash on this tour? You know,
that tone. Yeah. Just wondering.
Yeah. I mean, I was so fucked. It was incredible, you know. And, yeah. And like, and I didn't have a day job, and like, I just didn't know what to do. And then Will kind of sensed that I was motherfucked. And he I remember he wrote me and he said, "Hey, I have a really big show in London that pays a lot of money. Want to just have me and you play." Play the show, and,
right?
And then I was like, yeah, "Thanks, yeah, that's great."
Yeah,
and then he sent an email that said challenge, and there were two lyrics, and he was like, "How about you make songs out of these lyrics, and we'll play them at the London show?" So I was like, "Okay, you know," and I've never been asked to do that, so I did, and that's sort of how Superwolf got started. Was we played these songs, and it was fucking terrifying, because I was used to playing loud rock bands, and all of a sudden, just me and a singer. With some song that I just made up and it's like a really big crowd and it was terrifying
but
and
exciting. Really
fun. Fucking A, yeah, super exciting.
So it's just you and him on that record?
Mm-hmm.
Who played drums?
And our friend Pete Townsend, not that one.
Yeah.
Pete Townsend from Louisville plays drums on that. And
it's a pretty record.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, so Will really helped me out when I was, you know, like just didn't know what to do. And then through that Superwolf record, Rick Rubin, I guess, heard it.
Yeah.
And called me up out of the blue and just asked me to start.
What'd he say about the record?
He said the nicest things in the world. I would sound like I was lying if I actually quoted it, because I'd sound like a dick. But he said really, really nice things about it. You know, like I was just like my end of the conversation was, yeah?
Yeah.
Really? Whoa, thanks. No way.
This fuck. Is really Rick Rubin.
Dude, wow, fuck, fuck, cool. Really? You know? And then he said, you wanted to see if I was available to play in records. And, you know, so I said, fuck no, you know, hell no. No, I didn't. I was like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And then I got a call like a couple of days later, you know, I was like, I'm calling from Rick Rubin's office. Is this Matt Sweeney? Yeah. Checking your availability to play on Johnny Cash sessions. And I was like, I'm assuming these are overdubs because Johnny Cash had died.
Yeah.
And then there's like this beat on the other end. They're like, Mr. Cash recorded two albums worth of material with the express purpose of them being finished after his death. Are you interested? So I said, yeah, you know, like, and then I kind of asked around a little bit about exactly what was going on. And sure enough, he had done like 20 songs at his house when he was going, you know, and they had been sitting on these recordings, kind of dreading having to do it, but it was agreed. Like this,
right?
Like, it was like his will, you know.
Right.
Like
his last wish.
Yeah, and I was the, and because Rick liked this record that I made with Will, I was the new guy, and everybody else was like the guys who had played and all. It was basically it was Mike Campbell,
the Heartbreakers.
Yeah. You know, and so I've never done any fucking studio stuff, you know, like that. So it was insane, you know, like so I show up, you know, and
with your guitar.
You know what? I didn't bring a guitar because I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I didn't even own an acoustic guitar, and I figured they're gonna have a lot of guitars. It's like Rick Rubin,
right.
And also I kind of figured, well, I can't bring anything to the session. I can't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I figured that I just have to improv,
right?
Which ended up kind of really working out well, because I didn't have to carry anything, so it was really nice.
Did they have guitars?
Yeah, there's like fucking tons, you know? It's like, of course, it's like, you know, like, can I use this guitar? Yeah, sure, you know?
Like good ones?
Like, yeah, dude, like this super guitar. Yeah, you can't just like, yeah, it's like, yeah.
100 guitars?
It's gross. Yeah. It's like, and it was, I remember going into Rick Rubin's house where he, this was in Hollywood where he used to do a lot of recordings, and I went in through the basement, and I heard this laughing from the room. I just found my way, and I took like a weird door. I took like a side door entrance, and I didn't want to meet anybody. I just wanted
the Houdini house?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's
on Laurel Canyon.
That's not, no, not the
oh,
other
his
one.
Actual house.
The 1331 Miller Drive, which I think he's gotten rid of. But yeah, not the Houdini house. This other house, which also was a similarly fabulous haunted Hollywood mansion.
Right.
And I remember going in through the basement and not telling anybody I had arrived, and hearing this laughing. They hear this like, oh my God, like this like kind of hillbilly laughter. And I walk in, and there's this guy sitting there looking at a computer screen that I can't see what's on the screen. And he's like, who are you? This scary guy. And I was like, I'm Matt Sweeney. He's like, oh, you're the new guy.
Yeah.
He's like, I was like, yeah, I guess I am. He's like, well, I hope you're ready to make the best goddamn record of your life. And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, I'm Fergie. I've worked with Johnny Cash for 30 years, and I am so tired of doing this. This is killing me. That's the first thing he said, because he's like, bro, this is like really... this is sad shit. I hope you're ready to get into this. He was really like, he just like, and that was another big moment for me. I was like, wow, I have to make a record for this guy.
Yeah.
Because this is the guy who is seeing through his kind of mentor's thing.
Yeah.
And he was the only guy from Johnny Cash's world, I think, that Rick brought along when, and then he was laughing at the computer screen because he had a picture of Jimmy Martin, who's this hillbilly singer.
Yeah.
In front of like 1,000 dead squirrels.
What?
Yeah, he was like looking at like hillbilly porn or whatever. Like, and then all these other guys come in, and it's like, I couldn't believe it. It was the most surreal thing. Like, it's the Heartbreakers.
Really?
Like, they show up, you know.
Benmont and all of them?
Yeah. And I'm fucking freaking out, you know. And then it's
never
just,
met him before. You're just like, I am Matt.
Yeah, I was just like this idiot. Like, and I never, they had no idea. They don't know who the fuck I am. They've
I've
never
been
heard
to
Chavez.
I had a weird moment.
Yeah. They don't know Wilhelm Chavez. Fuck no, they don't know any of that stuff. So I'm just this guy, you know. And then it was just Johnny Cash's voice to a click track. And we just sit there and figure out the songs, and we ended up recording
just the melody, no guitar.
It'd be in the key of C, and they had isolated the tracks, and he would just have his friends play when he was recording. He'd just have his friends play just as like a guide track, you know. So then those guide tracks were wiped clean, and so we would just come
raw voice.
Raw
it must have been haunting.
It was fucking cool, and we just did it all live, and we ended up. It was incredibly fun, you know what I mean?
First time you've ever been in a studio, and you're in there
on that level,
basically with the Heartbreakers.
Yeah, playing to the disembodied voice of Johnny Cash.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was really strange. But that was...
Were these original songs or covers?
Both.
Yeah.
A lot of covers and some originals.
Wow.
It was cool. It worked so well that then, like, Rick would let me stay late, and me and Ferg would kind of mess around with like that song Ain't No Grave and God's Gonna Cut You Down were two that we kind of got to be like really mess with, you know, and like I kind of turned it into a minor key song even though it was a major key song and stuff. And I mean just Rick was so fucking nice that he let me.
It was just you and Rick and Ferg.
Yeah, and then Rick would leave and be like, yeah, if you want to try something, go ahead, you know.
on those tracks, is it only you and Johnny?
No, I mean, it's Smokey and Mike and stuff like that, but Mike Campbell, Smokey Hormel, who's plays on tons of Rick stuff, and Smokey made it. All these guys were so nice to me. That's the other thing, is like Smokey and Benmont were so friendly to me, and they, you know, they could have been total jerks if they wanted to. And Rick had the best advice. I was like, so can I just play whatever I want? He goes, yeah, do whatever you want. We could always hit a race.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh, right. I guess I can just do that. But yeah. I ended up being able to, I'm featured on 5 and 6. Like I could, there's a lot of
you
parts, a lot of me on there.
Cash 5 and 6.
Yeah, 5 and 6. Yeah.
The posthumous ones.
Yeah, and they're hard to listen to because he's dying. You know what I mean? Like the vocals are tough. I mean, I'm proud of those records. I don't think that they're for everybody. You know what I mean? But Ferg loves them, and Ferg, who's Johnny Cash's guy, and
he loved him.
That's what I, you know, so then I just started working for Rick a lot, and so I get to meet all these, and I live in New York, and then I get to go out to LA and, you know, play with like Cat Stevens.
But what was it? Who else did you play with? Neil Diamond too?
Yeah.
Did you do those
sessions?
That's
how I got my acoustic, actually, is Neil Diamond gave me this insane acoustic guitar. And I always had this dream. I was like, I can't afford a Martin, you know?
Yeah.
But like, I was like, maybe someday some rich guy will like give me a Martin. I don't know. How else would it happen?
Right.
And then after I was friends with Neil, I went by one time, me and Smokey went by his studio because we both happened to be in town. And he's like, yeah, come by the studio. And his son was getting rid of all these guitars. He's like, yeah, look at this one. And he's this beautiful beat up Martin.
In LA?
Yeah, yeah. He like right next to Cedar Sinai.
Uh-huh.
It's Sam Cooke's old studio. It's the Liberty Records studio. Uh-huh. Neil's been in there since the early 70s, and it's fucking awesome. It's like frozen in time.
Wow.
Like 1978, like amazing.
Like, so you go over there after you record with Neil, so he knows you.
Yeah. The Rick things, it just became this thing where it was like, I couldn't believe that it was happening. You know, any session, I just couldn't believe I was
which
there.
Which ones did you do?
But as far as like crazy legends that I couldn't believe,
yeah.
like Neil Diamond, Cat Stevens.
Rick recorded Cat Stevens?
Yeah, the last one, yeah. He did the raw tracks with Rick, and then he ended up finishing it in different studios and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But Neil Diamond in particular, like I'm crazy about his
really?
Music. I love Neil Diamond. Always have. Like,
really?
Always. Yeah. Just like little.
Because that's a pretty sparse record, you right?
Oh, it's, yeah. The record that we did, was like, there's like 10 minute long, really sparse, weird songs. It was so much fun. It was really, really cool.
So you get to know Neil.
Yeah. He's a pal. He's so, dude, he sometimes like texts me and shit.
Oh, really?
It's fucking insane. I was recording with a rapper actually recently, and I was like, I just got a text from Neil Diamond. I could tell the rapper was just like kind of bummed.
It
was
right.
I was just kind of like, you know, I just won. You know, if rap is about being like cool,
what rapper?
It was LP, who's great. He's a really good friend. I love working with him, and he does a thing called Run the Jewels now, which is great. I really recommend it. It's kind of blowing up.
You and Blake Mills are buddies?
Yeah, actually, yeah. I brought Blake in. I actually introduced Blake to Rick, because which was again classic kind of career suicide, because that guy is
a wizard.
Yeah, you know, it's like I do pencil sketches and he's like a sculptor,
right?
You know, guitar wise.
Rick didn't know him either. So what does Rick just sit up in the mountain?
I mean, he knows guys, and then he has guys that he trusts,
right?
You know, and stuff. And so like in this case, this was a Kid Rock record, and Rick was like, yeah, you know anybody else who would be good for a guitar? You know, I was like, well, this guy Blake, you know, and that was Blake's first Rick session. And then all of a sudden I stopped getting Rick sessions, and then Blake was
no,
but actually a couple of times, but that's fine because I live in New York.
Yeah.
And you know what's neat is actually Blake, he's the best guitar player in the world, but he doesn't step on, I never felt like.
Right, you know, right.
Like what's the Amadeus situation?
Salieri.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a moment though, I do remember, I was like, is this going to be this? Did I just completely fuck myself?
You know? You got to tour with Cat Stevens. How the fuck did.
Oh yeah. So what's great about the Rick things is that sometimes I'll hit it off with the artist, and then I'll just kind of do stuff outside of the Rick world. Just, you know, just play shows and do some stuff. So, I mean, again, it was like the biggest golden pile of shit that I stepped in with. Well, I don't want to call Rick a golden pile of shit.
Wasn't lucky. The lucky thing was that he heard the record.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the weird thing about it. It happened, had integrity to it. It's like, who's that guy?
Yeah, it was cool. And also, we didn't do any press for that record, the Super Wolf record.
That's the record I heard you on.
Yeah. It's been fucking 10 years. It's so crazy.
That's 10 years old?
Yeah.
Was it you and Blake and Billy Gibbons who did Oh Well?
Yeah, that was a thing where Rick had got. That's another obvious one. Billy Gibbons, as far as the Rick thing goes, when we were working on the Cash stuff,
did he do a ZZ Top record?
Yeah, he did the last one.
He did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
It's good.
It is good.
Yeah.
Did you hear? Did you hear Billy play fucking the Ballad of Billy the Kid on?
It's fucking awesome.
Why doesn't he do a whole record?
I know. Well, that's been an obsession of mine.
But now let me just like preface this by saying, so you heard Billy play that thing on my podcast.
Yes, it's incredible. So I was talking to Rick about Billy Gibbons. He's like, well, I'm friends with him, but I never really checked out ZZ Top like hardcore. I was like, really? You know? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, dude, they're the best band ever.
Like the first five records.
Yes, they are the greatest things ever.
Yeah.
Yes. I can't. I'm obsessed. And so Rick started talking to Billy about making a record.
Right.
And then I sent Rick an email saying, you know, if you're talking to Billy about making a record, I think you should talk to him about Peter Green, because I as far as I can tell, that could be a good dialogue opener. You know what I mean? Like, as far as
that should be the dialogue opener with every guitar.
I know it's true. Yeah, and Peter Green for listeners is the
they know my listeners know. I never shut up about Peter Green.
Yeah. So
the original Fleetwood Mac guitar player,
Fleetwood Mac guy, the best,
the wizard of blues, the best blues player.
Yeah, and somehow doesn't sound like a white guy trying to be black.
I don't know
it's
what
just,
it
it's
is.
It's transcendent. It's just transcendent.
It is right.
Yeah, absolutely. So Gibbon sees that email that I wrote to Rick, and he's like, Billy wants to meet you. He wants to write with you. And I was the greatest phone call I've ever gotten, you know?
Right.
So I got instructions from Rick. Yeah. Meet up with him and play music that he likes, get him back into music because it seems like he sort of hasn't been that inspired, you know, like right. lately. So this was like my job, you know, like to fucking hang out with Billy Gibbons and like listen to listen to the Boston Tea Party Fleetwood Mac, you know, bootlegs.
Is that what you played with him?
Fuck yeah. We were just like Jesper from Endless Boogie, who's a friend of mine who was like a music, you know,
he's like a
wizard.
Crazy record collector, right?
Yeah. Well, Paul Major and Jesper, yeah, two of the guys in the band are like
in Endless Boogie.
Yes. Yeah.
They're out in the island, right?
No, actually, I called the record Long Island just because I thought it would be cool.
Oh.
No, they're all around here.
Yeah.
But Jesper is a great. I made this crazy mixtape with my friend who has like the libraries of music.
Jesper.
And stuff. Yeah,
and he's an Endless Boogie guitar player.
He's an Endless Boogie, and we made like five CDs called Vibe Action for Billy Gibbons of just like inspirational
ripping them from vinyl.
Everything. You know?
Yeah,
and that was sort of like, hey Billy, you know, I'm this guy Matt who wrote the thing.
You're trying to reprime the Gibbons pump.
And dude, he took to it. It was like, yeah, dude, check out this, you know, and we'd listen to music and then play a bit and we did this for a week and it was the greatest. I mean, I remember like that at the end of the first day, Gibbons was like, well, this just couldn't have gone any better. And I was like, I can't fucking believe this. This is awesome. And then
what were some of the other songs you were playing?
What was I playing? I mean, like,
he knew the Peter Green shit, didn't he?
Yeah, he knew the Peter Green stuff, but he hadn't listened to it for a while. But he's right. Like, you know, he's like, this is the best.
That was his guy, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And then a lot of African rock. Like, there's a good compilation called Africa Rocks, a band called Witch, uh-huh. A band called Amanaz.
Rich, I know Witch. They just reissued their vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, just like kind of stuff that I knew that Gibbons would like, but maybe hadn't heard, because that's what's cool about rock music. It is infinite, the amount of stuff that you haven't heard.
Right.
That's great. You know,
and you just sat with him and you'd get the guitars out and you'd follow him.
We would just kind of make shit up. Yeah.
Right.
It should be noted, none of these songs ever got used. but we had this incredible hang. Then I went back to do it again, and the vibe was completely different. And Gibbons didn't seem to be into it anymore. And then they started working on the record, and I was like, shit, did I just like blow it with Billy Gibbons somehow? You know. And then he met Blake, and then Blake was like, Gibbons wants to do something with me and you, like, let's just do it. You know. And
yeah.
So, and then there was the full circle back to doing
the single.
Yeah, and doing a Fleetwood Mac thing. And I mean, I was hoping that that would be the beginning of something. Where we could just,
I think he's afraid.
Yeah, he's so complicated. He's so brilliant, that guy. But
it's just interesting that, because like that Rick Rubin ZZ Top record, it's like, it's in the tradition of those original Rick Rubin records where it's like, we're gonna make a ZZ Top record the way it used to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it's good. It's okay, and his riffs are good.
Right.
But it's weird because he's so, like, these guys get older, and you so want them to honor their depth.
Right.
And I think a lot of them are just nervous to do it.
If there's that, and also you forget, and I've learned this from talking to these older guys, like I asked Gibbons about those 70s records.
Right.
Like, oh God, we'd just be sweating in a room, having to hang out with each other and just working. And just, you know, I was like, yeah.
You know? Like, yeah, yeah. Right.
You know, but like those memories probably aren't that great, you know, like
I guess
them,
so.
You know?
That was something to be transcended.
Yeah,
well,
you know.
Well, how about, I always hear about like Skynyrd, you know, working in a like a warehouse that was so hot, and it was hot on purpose.
Yeah.
And Al Cooper found them, they were just these sweaty guys that had been pounding these songs so hard. They knew them in their sleep.
Yeah, and so you're like, you know what, guys, why don't you get back to that? They're like, because I don't
Fuck
want
that.
To. I fucking hated doing that shit.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's one thing I found, and also a lot of people's like great work was they were kind of miserable in their personal lives. Then they become fucking millionaires. They live under a rock of wealth and fame, you know, and
they've got a sound.
Yeah.
You know, that,
I really think, I swear I have noticed this, that like guys who are hugely successful, they're not interested in people who aren't hugely successful. They're not interested in the records that they made that didn't sell. I think it's just something about money and power that makes people, not interested in going for something that doesn't equal money. I swear.
I can't, but after a certain point, like, I mean, they already made their money. I mean, it's not like that ZZ Top record didn't make money.
I know, but they still think that way. I swear.
I know, they still think they're going to get through the next ZZ Top record.
Yeah, yeah.
It's over.
I know. And also it's like, as far as I know, most of the things that end up really popping are things that you just made because you think were fucking awesome.
Right,
you know?
Right,
and then,
right.
And then people pick up on it. But I've just seen this with some bigger like acts who are just used to how things go. They're like, yeah, we need a hit. That whole mentality, you know?
Yeah, but it's weird because it's so gone. Like, Levon Helm knew better than others, you know, before he died, and he was recording those. I think he recorded on Vanguard.
Yeah,
he
the Dirt Farmer stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. I mean, it's for the people that want to find that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You got to stop thinking about hits.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
I
and
know.
It's like, even the Rolling Stones will make new songs or a new record, but like, when I talked to Keith Richards for 10 minutes, mm-hmm. You know, I said to him, why don't you guys make a blues record? He's like, well, that's been kicking around for a while. It's like, we'll just do it. Because if you listen to Love You Live, the Elmo Combo side.
Yeah.
It's like, where's that fucking record with that outfit?
That they can make in 5 fucking seconds.
In a second.
I know, but it's again, I'm sure.
Did you ever see that thing where Ronnie and Keith played with Dylan on the Sun City record?
No.
Like, it was weird because I remember seeing it at the concert when they recorded.
Like early 80s shit.
Well, yeah, it was thrown together. Right. You know, it was Bob Dylan in the middle of Keith and I think Ronnie, mm-hmm. and they all had guitars, mm-hmm. and it was pretty great. Mm-hmm. And then there was another song on that record called Silver and Gold, mm-hmm. that I think Keith played on. That record, the Sun City record, is kind of interesting.
Oh, huh, cool.
There's some weird players on there, but I just don't like. It's like you guys have already done it.
Yeah.
You're done with that.
Yeah, yeah.
You won.
Yeah.
So now honor your roots.
It would be great. It's this. I don't know. I don't get it either. But I just came to understand that it has something to do with these guys not wanting to lose money, not wanting to appear unsuccessful.
I think it's fear.
Yeah, it is fear. It's all fear. It's absolutely fear. For sure. For sure. You know what I mean?
And I don't know if there's anything we can do. Like that, like I just hold on to that little, I have it on my desktop. That
the Gibbons thing?
Yeah.
I was so excited because I was listening to that interview, just enjoying it. And then when you did that, I was like, no, oh my God, oh my God. And it's so fucking good.
So good.
It's so good. It's so
good. He's like,
And I don't want to appear disrespectful talking about fucking millionaires, blah, blah, blah. But I do think it's true. It's like they get used to
success. I think it's more being entrenched in what they think they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's very hard, even when you listen to the Tom Petty. Right. It's like, this is a guy, you know, one of the greatest American songwriters in the world. Mm. And then, you know, where you're expected to keep churning out this thing.
Right.
And they've all gone through it. Right. And I think that still in their head, they think that's the thing they churn out.
Yeah.
I don't know that Billy would necessarily even see that big of a difference between 70s ZZ Top and what they evolved into. I think he knows that the syncopated drum beat was not a good thing.
Right.
And his answer to that is that we were trying to get chicks to dance to it, which
right.
is fine.
Right.
You can, you know, but like, I don't think he sees any difference between any of that.
I think he would just want,
It's ZZ Top music.
And we talk about it a lot. We would have like kind of long, kind of circular conversations about it. And then it really did occur to me. I was like, I'm just some fucking a guy like me is like an obscurist.
Yeah.
Who's into things that are cool. And eventually the guys are like, you know what? Just because you're just this guy who thinks that things are cool. And you just, you know, like, if it's obscure, it's good. You know what? I'm not like that. That's what the successful
guy
says.
I'm Billy Gibbons.
You know what I mean?
Guy. Yeah.
And to be fair, Gibbons really does love a lot of...
No, he
loves a lot of weird shit, for
sweetheart.
Sure.
Sweetheart.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. He was weird shit. That story he told in the podcast about, like, hanging out with Hendrix, and Hendrix dragging the stereo down the hall.
To hear, like, Jeff Beck.
Yeah, they sit there and go, like, what the fuck is Jeff Beck doing?
So awesome. I mean, dude, what about Gibbons talking about Alex Chilton?
Yeah.
I mean, Big Star and fucking ZZ Top were making records at the same studio at the same time, which just blows my mind.
That's
crazy,
man.
Yeah, I remember Gibbons, actually, this is interesting. He goes, Alex Chilton, now he was interesting. He was a guy who really could have been very successful, but he chose to be a homeless.
So I think that, like, you know, you forget, like, in the way that music is fragmented and the way that you came up in music, that, you know, these guys came from the time where, like, we're going to make $1 billion.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's
and
probably right.
And they fucking
right.
did.
And they did.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So guys like that, I would love it. I think that Billy's absolutely got it in him for sure. I mean, he's a god.
He is.
He's just so great.
So tell me about this Endless Boogie thing. That was another one of those records where I got out of nowhere. What label is that on?
That's on a little label called No Quarter, which is a really small but really good label.
Somebody sent me that record, and like, you know, I'm going through records, and it's weird with me because I get like a lot of records.
Yeah.
And I'll throw them all on for one play.
Yeah.
And occasionally, like, you know, throw something on and I'm just go about my business and I'll walk back into the room like, the fuck is this? That was like, that was that record.
Yeah, Endless Boogie was one of my...
It was the weird sort of mountain cover.
Long Island, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a painting from Norway from like 1908, and it looks exactly like Paul Major. It looks like the guy who's
okay.
in... Yeah. Like, it's freaky. Endless Boogie was a band that was started as like a fun bunch of record collectors playing music in a rehearsal space that was my rehearsal space, and they started playing shows out after years of playing just in a
they're old guys space. Right,
yeah. Paul's like 60.
What's his name again?
Paul Major. That's his Christian name, Paul Major.
And he's like he's sort of notorious, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. He kind of invented a record market people call it real people music or private press records, mm-hmm. like records that major labels didn't make that people actually made themselves.
A lot of those are being reissued now.
Yeah, Vanity Press. Yeah, Paul kind of invented people finding those. That shit. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's so cool. And so sweet.
Like the Dark album, or
do you know that? Yeah. Paul found that record
because you can't find the real one. I mean,
the real one's worth something like $5,000.
Right. So yeah. like there's, I'm getting a lot of those reissues because you know Daniel Cook. Do you know Daniel Cook?
Daniel Cook. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's got his joint now is out in L.A. It's right around the corner from me.
Oh, fucking dude. Say hi to Daniel. He's fucking awesome.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. That's so amazing.
But he gets all these re-releases of those records.
Yeah.
And I get them through him.
You're stoked. That's
Because
you have your dealer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Paul and Jesper from Boogie were those guys for me who were just like always turning me on to stuff. And they had this band and they were my favorite band forever. Like I had seen... I remember I saw Crazy Horse and Endless Boogie on the same night, and I swear to God, I could not pick one from the other as far as like what was godlike guitar.
Really?
It was perfect.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
Paul,
yeah.
Paul can really do it.
And, yeah.
And then I just started playing. When they started making records, I started playing with them and kind of sort of co-producing the records and stuff. So I kind of ended up being the third guitar player in Endless Boogie, and that's the thing that I do whenever I can. I make records with them whenever I can.
Well, I guess my question to you then, as a guitar player and as somebody who I appreciate your guitar playing, because you're not a stand up out front, you know, showboat.
I like to.
And it seems like you've learned from insecurity, and sort of evolving through
self hatred. And
well, there's that, but there's also the reality of like showing up to do those cash records and realizing that you can't be a showboat.
Yeah,
and you're up against some real shit, and you've got to be sort of honest about how you play,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That you found the honesty of how you play.
My grandmother was influential because she was really into accompanyists.
Yeah.
She worked for David O. Selznick, like the Gone with the Wind producer.
Yeah.
She was really into movies, and she would always talk about the piano player, like about how beautiful this piano playing is
right.
against this vocal, and how like how the music's almost invisible and stuff. And,
right.
And I remember that was kind of stuck in my head. And I remember I had that in mind when all of a sudden I was with these great singers. I was like, okay, don't play when they're singing. That's what you do.
Not time for lead licks.
And then play something off of what when they're not singing. Play something simple that's sort of like what they sang. That's my fucking. That's what I do. You know. I mean, uh-huh. like, and that's kind of what most I think people would do.
But I
never thought about that. You
right.
know? Like I never thought about that. Like as simple as that.
Right.
Know? And that's what I learned. Kind of, I started picking up on that from playing with Will Oldham and stuff. You know, he taught me a lot about how to play with a singer. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
So that's kind of what I do. You
and
know?
Also, it's like, it's a clean sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even if the guitar is dirty, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, because again, I'm such a Luddite and a spaz that I can't deal with pedals. And I don't think my hearing is particularly... I'm not great at mixing. I'm not a tone freak. But I think if you play with your fingers, you kind of will get a good sound. And like
I wish we had some guitars here, so you could show me that thing.
Fucking, I almost brought one. Well, you're gonna be in town. We'll just come.
Yeah, you could come do it. Come do a comedy show.
Yeah, dude, I'd love to.
All right,
totally love to.
Well, you got to go eat with your mom.
Yes, I do.
All right, man. Good talk.
Great, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Matt Sweeney, check him out, man. Check out that Superwolf record and everything else. That, you know, go have a superiority burger. Do what you got to do. Go hang out with Matt. He's fun to hang out with. Oh, justcoffee.coop. You get the WTF blend, I get a little on the back end. God, where's that fucking guitar, man? Fender champ forever.